You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenlon.
To celebrate reaching 500,000 listens on this podcast, and to thank all of our listeners who have come along for the ride, I wanted to do something a little different on the podcast today. And so in this episode, I'm going to talk about how to survive in this job. I have both personally experienced and witnessed colleagues experiencing the damaging negative effects of working with trauma, which is perhaps not surprising when you consider that our job is to advise and advocate for people in the most extreme moments of their lives. People facing eviction, conviction, loss of liberty, loss of their children, end of their marriage, sexual or domestic violence, and detention in mental health facilities. This kind of work takes a toll, and it's high time that lawyers collectively recognise and address this. I'm delighted to say that Joanna Fleck and Rachel Francis have agreed to speak with me about their book Vicarious Trauma in the Legal Profession, a practical guide to trauma, burnout, and collective care, which I think should be required reading for anybody considering entering this profession. A quick note before we begin, that some of the cases referred to have traumatic case detail. So my first question to both of you, how did you come up with this idea for this book and for your project?
Thanks so much for having us on the podcast. It's really lovely to be here, and what a treat to be doing it at the significant milestone that you've reached in terms of listeners. So in terms of the kernel of an idea that produced this book, it's probably better to start by speaking about how Joanna and I created Claiming Space. So we worked together on the Committee of Young Legal Aid Lawyers some years ago, and I went on to be co-chair of Young Legal Aid Lawyers. And we had a conversation as I was coming to the end of my tenure, where Joanna was doing some really exciting work with persons, vulnerable persons who were working on the front line in other contexts, so more clinical settings, non-legal settings, and felt very strongly in an email that she sent me that I've never been able to find since, but it's so kind of sat so clearly and firmly in my mind about the need to do something practical immediately, especially for young lawyers who are dealing with this significant level of trauma in their caseload that followed on quite sharply from the introduction of the Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Act, and really to try and do something to stop the level of burnout and the level of people who were leaving the profession. So we thought, what can we do? And we created this community interest company called Claiming Space, and we had three intentions at that time. One was to create a space for young lawyers, particularly up to 10 years PQE, to learn, share and reflect on the impact of working with trauma, and to do that regularly. So we set up monthly peer support sessions to embed that idea of reflective practice. The second one was to deliver training on vicarious trauma, burnout, compassion fatigue and associated issues in firms and organisations. And the third one was to just take any platform that anyone would give us to talk about these issues, whether that was on a blog or in an article or at a conference, and to use that to begin to kind of leverage the issue within the profession. We set that up in October 2017. After we'd done that for a number of years, we really felt that there was a message that people were giving back to us, that this was incredibly important work. They wanted to know about the research behind it, the principles behind it, and we wanted to disperse that to a wider group of people. So we brought all of that together in this book, Vicarious Trauma in the Legal Profession, which we're going to talk about a little bit more. But that was really kind of condensing all of that work into a slim volume that was manageable, but also hard hitting in terms of the research, the principles behind these issues, including case studies that people charting their experiences of these issues and practical solutions for what to do about it. So that was kind of our trajectory of getting from an initial conversation via email to having a published book in 2021, which is quite exciting, really.
Absolutely. And it makes me laugh that you wanted to take advantage of any opportunity to talk about these sorts of issues on whatever panels would have you, because it does occur to me that I'm regularly asked to speak on careers panels, and everyone wants to know about how do I get a job in human rights, or how do I get a job in various fields? And so few people talk about the mental health toll. It so rarely comes up that students are reminded that if you go into an area where you will be talking about trauma and the worst thing that has ever happened to anyone for most of your day, that will have an impact. And one of the things that I found really interesting about the book was that you indicated a degree of skepticism about the focus on resilience and sort of personal responsibility for dealing with how difficult this job can be. I thought that was fascinating.
As you were saying that, Emma, I was thinking that the kind of creation of Claiming Space and what we've been doing has kind of mapped alongside me leaving the profession. And actually, what we're saying is not how do you get a job, it's how do you not leave the job if you want to stay in it. Because I think ultimately I probably would have moved on to something else at some point, but I feel at some stages that was slightly taken out of my hands because I was in positions where I wasn't coping with the level of trauma and the complexity of trauma that I was dealing with in my caseload. So I'm no longer practicing, but I think, and that journey that Rachel was talking about, a lot of what was the wake-up call was speaking to other professions and telling them what we do and the kinds of stories we listen to and the kinds of people we meet and get to know over sometimes very long periods, really in really intense situations. And then also their disbelief in the lack of support and training and supervision and any kind of knowledge base that there was available to us.
I occasionally go back home and my mum asks me what I've been working on. And it's really only when I'm describing to someone who has no knowledge of the law that you sort of see what is a totally rational response to somebody describing that they have been working for 2 weeks on a case involving a death in prison, followed by 2 weeks in a child abuse inquiry, followed by 2 weeks doing something else. And it's the problem, I think, is that so many of us take for granted that this is just our lot. That I think it's enormously helpful that having taken a step back from this, you're sort of able to reflect back to the profession that actually what we're doing isn't particularly normal. But one of the things I thought was interesting in the first part of the book is that you distinguish between extreme stress, which if you watch Suits or any of those legal dramas, you'll at least have an idea that lots of lawyers face. So the sort of stresses that come from billing targets and deadlines and firefighting problems and dealing with difficult bosses or clients or judges, and then trauma, and how those two things, they can sometimes overlap, but how they are in fact different things. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about how you see that distinction.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I think it's really helpful to separate them out in the context of the legal profession, because working in the areas that Rachel and I have worked in and the people we work with, there's this sense of like, yes, we have a lot of the stresses and strain of being in legal practice, being a very regulated profession, being a profession that's held to very high standards in lots of different areas, having competitive jobs and training processes, all of those things, and that there being something different about this work, there being something extra that we carry. I think in that way it's helpful to make the distinction, to acknowledge that there's something more about that that might have a more emotional resonance. In terms of the actual kind of theory and science, you know, we're not clinicians, and I think there may be people who can better explain what specific differences there might be. The two ways we kind of think about it is, on the one hand, it's just a bit of a spectrum, because you can't really divide stress and traumatic stress. There's no precise dividing line. It's important to make that distinction because there is something different about the kind of lack of safety and the threat to the level of kind of threat and seriousness of what we're dealing with. But at the same time, we're not trying to ask people to make a clear distinction. What is experienced as intensely traumatic? Some people might not be for other people, depending on a whole range of factors. So as much as it's helpful to make that division, to acknowledge what's different about this work, we're kind of at the same time, we want to keep it quite broad. There's no one definition of trauma that I think will suit everyone.
Drawing those two themes together, so our antipathy towards the word resilience and what Joanna was setting out so clearly in terms of the different weight and different category that trauma and traumatic stress are kind of attracts, versus some of the more standard stresses of legal practice is exactly what Joanna was just explaining. The trauma is systemic as well. And so it's not reasonable to say to an individual, there's an expectation you should be resilient, because there's a lack of logic. You cannot be resilient when there's a system wearing you down. It's not a kind of personal issue. There's also a systemic issue. But the other difficulty with requiring people to demonstrate resilience is not only does it shift the problem onto them and again make it very individualized rather than a system problem and a collective problem as well, it shuts down the conversation and it makes people feel like they're not coping, they're not enough. Whereas, of course, as you said, it's so natural that you would feel really impacted by working with trauma so regularly and back to back without breaks in a way that it just doesn't characterize the ordinary working life of the general population. So it can be a really difficult and weighty word in a negative way in our experience, and one that just stifles honest conversations about these issues.
It's a word that is particularly unfamiliar to those who are senior in the profession, because what I found amusing in preparation for this podcast is that I mentioned it to a very senior colleague in chambers, and while he has immense experience dealing with psychiatric harm amongst his clients, it literally had not occurred to him that vicarious trauma was a thing for lawyers, which I find so fascinating, that it's not even that we don't have necessarily have the vocabulary, it's that the concept has yet to fully form in some people's minds. And so I wanted to explore this a little bit with you. What is vicarious trauma for lawyers, and what is it about it that is different?
So the way that we describe vicarious trauma in the book, and one that we think has particular utility for doing legal aid work or social justice work or any work with vulnerable populations, is to think about it first and foremost as a neutral term of exposure. So if you divide it into its component parts, one is being vicariously, so indirectly, exposed to trauma. And that is a very normal part of doing this work. So that's the starting point. It's a form of exposure, and it is descriptive of the way that we encounter traumatic cases and traumatic material in our cases and traumatized clients. There then is kind of how that manifests in a practitioner. And that again divides into kind of two specific areas. One is its impact that it has on your worldview, so the general way that you look at life. And one could say that you might enter the profession with a more benign worldview, an idea that the world is a generally safe place in which occasional incidents of difficulty, trauma, or darkness occur. And then as you spend more time in the profession, it gravitates towards the other end of the spectrum, which is this idea that we live in a desperately difficult and traumatic world, full stop, with occasional rays of light. But in terms of how it might manifest in individual practitioners, there's again a spectrum, a bit like Joanna was describing, on the kind of spectrum of stress to traumatic stress. And that spectrum ranges from the negative impacts of vicarious trauma, so experiencing vicarious traumatization or secondary traumatic stress or compassion fatigue or burnout, so those negative impacts. There then is this kind of midway, resilient, neutral, happy worker who Joanna and I have not met that often, but apparently does exist, perhaps the person that you were referring to in your chambers just then. And then on the other end of the spectrum is the positive impacts of vicarious trauma and the positive effects, which is this idea of vicarious resilience. So the idea that you walk alongside your client, you bear witness to their trauma and their journey, but also their growth and the way that they are able to manage in extraordinarily difficult scenarios and yet still live sometimes and to live with grace. So that's how we describe it. And we hope that that is a helpful framework for people to consider when they're thinking about the impact of their work.
I would just add, I think in terms of the way that we're exposed to it, there's the multitude of ways that lawyers are exposed to it, from being, you know, some may have much more experience being in the room with someone or hearing live evidence, or it may be more, particularly at the junior end, there's a lot of kind of quite passive consumption by reading through statements and watching CCTV. And all of those are different ways of being exposed to the trauma. And then there's also the kind of vicarious trauma that exists in the organisations and systems. The fact that actually the legal system itself is quite a traumatic system for a lot of people, and working in certainly not all organisations, but there are people who are having to do this incredibly difficult work in organisations that are themselves traumatic because of the structures and the way that you get a lot of traumatised lawyers together who aren't really dealing with their trauma. It's only going to just keep bouncing and kind of some kind of exponential growth going on there. So I think that's something that through the pandemic people have become more aware of, actually, how we function as organisations, how we support each other as organisations. And that's, I think, something that is going to become increasingly a focus, I think, hopefully, moving away from that individual resilience into something a little bit more collective.
One of the things that read true for me when I was reading your book is the observation that burnout, and one of the most pernicious effects of burnout, is the extent to which it affects lawyers' ability to work as effectively as they're used to. I imagine lots of people listening to this podcast are themselves lawyers or know lawyers. And as a bunch, it's probably fair to say that we have more overachievers than the average population group. Certainly, I don't think I can think of a single colleague of mine who isn't an overachiever in some way, shape or form. And there are people who hold themselves to almost impossible standards. And I wonder if there's something in that, the idea that it is so much more difficult for people with those high standards of themselves to admit to struggling, when lots of how we are perceived in our job and how well we're handling things is part of our identity. Do you think that there's something in that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we did kind of review the research that was published at the time of writing into kind of the legal profession, and there's kind of hints along the way, but the research is quite limited. And I think there's something, I don't know if it's the place for academic research, but it's something I'm certainly interested in terms of what it is specifically about the way we work as lawyers, the kind of role and persona and everything we take on as lawyers, that might also have an impact on how we are affected by it, because the research so far indicates that lawyers are dealing with this much worse than other professions. And I think there's lots of reasons for that, but I'd be surprised if that wasn't one of them. And that feeling like being really proud of your problem-solving brain, and that's like the first bit to go when you're experiencing traumatic stress. That's the bit that kind of goes completely haywire or completely shuts down. And certainly when I was first leaving the profession, I left the profession in waves, but with the first wave of leaving, looking back, I can see that my productivity, my billable hours were just plummeting. And without kind of any blame, because this was the system that we all work, that is so familiar, no one asked me, and I didn't ask myself what that was. It was just a problem to be solved, and the solution was increase your hours, make up that time, come in at weekends and work more. And that's what I knew to be true about the profession. That's what the system tells you. And it's the exact opposite of what I could possibly do.
I'm so glad that you brought up the relatively nascent field of research in this area, because, I mean, as a bunch, we're all obsessed with evidence-based assertions. So part of me reading this book was thinking, well, that's just an anecdote, even if it does totally map my own experience. And then I would read another one, I think, well, that's just an anecdote, even if it does totally map my friend's experience. And then it was when I got to the studies that I thought, oh my God. Because one of those, for example, shows that lawyers working with traumatized clients seem to have poorer mental health than other professionals working in similar client groups. They also have higher rates of secondary trauma and burnout. And there was another study that found that lawyers tended to attribute the negative symptoms that they were experiencing to a lack of preparedness in dealing with traumatized client groups. And that's certainly my own experience. And there is something quite bizarre about being a first-year tenant and your client explaining to you the child abuse that they experienced when they were a child, and knowing that you are amongst the very first people they have told about that abuse, and not really having the tools to deal with that yourself, but also to be sure that you are taking the best care you can of somebody exposing a very secret and personal side to them. I think the lack of training is something as a theme that runs through this book, whether it's the case studies or the research or indeed some of the action points that we'll get onto in a minute. How do you feel about training as a response to this issue?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is the statistics are absolutely staggering. And considering that we are an evidence-based profession, we are not listening to the evidence. You occasionally get reported, like Family Law Week will pick up some survey results, or there will be some coverage of the research that you've just taken us through, Emma. And everyone will say, gosh, this is very shocking. And then nothing happens. And you're absolutely right. The answer, or one of the answers, is training, and that is just so sorely lacking. And although, of course, yes, the case studies are anecdotal, they do provide a qualitative slant on that research, because these are issues that practitioners are experiencing daily. The difficulties of dealing with clients, as you've just described, who are within minutes of meeting you, providing the most intimate details at a time when you are feeling overwhelmed by that because you're very new, perhaps, or it's a new type of case, or there's a dynamic in your life which means that it's particularly hard to take on that information at that time, and you don't have the requisite training. So how is that you performing your job and your role as a lawyer in a way that is safe for you and safe for the client, and one that's meeting the best interests and the just outcomes for that client? These are some of the most vulnerable people in the UK that we are dealing with on the daily, and yet we do them the disservice of not having the adequate training to meet the intensity of their trauma and the demands of their cases. That has to change. And one of the things that Joanna and I really hope from this book is that it will be, in various different ways, a clarion call, as Baroness Helena Kennedy QC describes it, to the need for this training. It has to happen. It's too late for some, but it's not too late for others. And I say that in relation to junior practitioners, but also senior practitioners. It's so important. And it gives people in themselves kind of a confidence in the way that they're conducting themselves professionally. Because there is nothing like coming out of a client meeting and thinking, oh my goodness, I really feel like I dropped the ball there. It's just a gross feeling, and it sticks with you. So the training helps you kind of on a personal level just not feel like that and do a great job, which is what we all want to do in our kind of ambitious, determined, problem-solving way that we do. So yeah, it really is a travesty.
So I wanted to now talk about the second part of the book, because I like the way it's laid out. There's the defining the problem and calling it what it is, and then there's the addressing the problem section. And in your action section, there's sort of a call to do a number of things. It's not merely about individuals sorting this out for themselves, but I particularly liked the focus on creating, for example, supportive cultures and recognizing that organizational structure is a real issue here. Could you just talk through some of the actions that you think are effective in addressing this on a collective basis?
Really against the whole current and the whole nature of the work that we do is to actually sometimes stop and not be productive and not be ticking off to-do lists and have space, whether that's ensuring that practitioners have the space in their diaries on an individual level to take care of themselves as a part of their job, not as something that they do outside of their work, but actually as part of their responsibility as a ethical practitioner, is to make sure that they're dealing with these things as they come up. And also ensuring that there's space, both formally and informally, for peer support, because that's, I think the book gives a sense of that peer support when you, I mean, for me, reading or taking those case studies was almost an element of peer support in that I really recognised myself. And it was, again, a reminder that I wasn't alone then and I'm not alone now with those feelings. So having that peer support, people who really understand, there really is so much about the legal profession that is just utterly peculiar to everyone else and utterly normal to us. And so having people who you don't need to explain all that nonsense to is really valuable. And then having a kind of, ultimately, what we would say is the gold standard, which is readily available and regular external, non-legal or clinical supervision for practitioners to what regularity and extent depends on the particular kinds of work that people are doing and their workload and what their needs are. But I think that's something that should become the standard that any good chambers or firm or organisation is aiming for.
One of the things that complements the peer support and the framework that Joanna has just been describing is safe and honest workplaces where the topics and themes in this book are normal and are discussed and are not hot potatoes, and you will not be oppressed or repressed for mentioning them, and people won't say incredulously, "What do you mean?" Which is one of the reasons why talking about this as widely as possible is so important, because it normalizes what is in fact a very normal part of doing this work and means that people have the courage to speak up before they get to the stage where they are utterly burnt out and they do not see an option for themselves to remain in this profession. We want people to have the tools that enable them to have safe and productive working lives right now, but also in longevity. So it's about embedding those cultures within a workplace. And that can be kind of like a bit of a, what does that mean? What does that look like? But I think it's going to depend on the individual organisations about how free and easy it is for that kind of space to exist and that latitude to exist. And the final thing to say is that it's all about routine. Regrettably, none of this is a click your fingers magic scenario. It's a work in progress. It's a practice. You have to keep working at it. But you also need working structures that permit you, as Joanna said, as part of your work, to build in the necessary breaks and recuperation to survive doing really difficult cases of child abuse or whatever they are, in a way that's manageable for you and your working flexibility and the latitude you've got within yourself, which is quite personal.
One of the things I should have said at the beginning is that this book is very much designed for claimant legal aid lawyers, but as somebody who does probably about 50-50 in terms of claimant defendant work, I still found it enormously useful. And some of that is because you can be acting for a mental health trust or for a prison, and you are still in a courtroom with people describing the worst thing that they could imagine happening to them in their lives. And I totally appreciate the difference between having to then go into the room and advise and advocate on behalf of family members, but it's not nothing being on the other side of things, particularly when you are so helpless as somebody who is experiencing and witnessing that evidence and not necessarily being able to do very much about it. So I would say to anyone considering reading this book, it's not the case that it only applies, or certainly I haven't found it the case that it only applies and only has benefit to people who are claimant only legal aid lawyers. I think its reach should be so much broader than that. And so just to finish then, one of the things it occurs to me is that the return to work following COVID is a real chance for organisations to rethink how they operate and for individuals to think about their job satisfaction. And I wonder if this is exactly the right time for those in the profession, particularly anybody senior listening to this podcast, to think about the way in which their firm or chambers operates and treats the new entrants to the profession.
Such an important point, Emma, and thanks so much for raising it in closing. You put it so well, I don't know whether I can add to it other than to say that the experience that Joanna and I have had of training people on these issues recently has really brought that particular point to the forefront on each occasion, where people are saying, I am for the first time discussing regularly with my peers at work and potentially even with my supervisor the real difficulty of doing this work because it has intruded into my home life in a way that is unprecedented for me. And there have been unprecedented pressures as a result of the pandemic as well. And people do want to do things differently. So there is a will, we just have to find a way with that. And so I think perhaps the book is very well timed because it's instructive as to some of the practical steps that can be taken. And it's also instructive in terms of the lived experience that practitioners are having, which has become even more intense as a result of doing this work in such a difficult set of circumstances for such a prolonged period of time. So we really urge everybody to take this opportunity and to think creatively and to think what has worked, what can we learn and take forward from this period, rather than trying to confine it to the annals of history, because most of it's been pretty horrible. There's definitely real learning opportunities for us.
Thank you both so much. I'm told that the publishers, and in particular Esther at LAG, can arrange for electronic or bulk buys should that be of interest to anybody. And we will, as we always do, include a link to the book and to everything discussed today on the UK Human Rights blog post that accompanies this episode. But all I want to say is thank you both so much, not only for coming on and describing the book, but for putting the work in and getting the book written.
Thank you, Emma.
Thanks so much for having us. It's been really great to come on the podcast. Thank you.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.